How are you?
I'll call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a series of public hearings today, and Chris, we don't have any bills for introduction, correct?
Correct.
Okay, we will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 40. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 40 would allow the Attorney General to issue an order disqualifying a charitable organization from receiving contributions that would otherwise be deductible under the Oregon income or corporate excise taxes. Such an order would be contingent upon the finding that the organization failed to spend at least 30% of its total annual functional expenses on program services when averaged over the most recent three fiscal years for which the Attorney General has relevant information. It would allow the organizations to request a contested case hearing within 60 days after notification of a proposed disqualification. It also allows the Attorney General to decline to issue a disqualification order under certain circumstances and identifies certain organizations that are exempt. It would also require organizations to disclose that such an order has been issued when making solicitations in Oregon and require the Attorney General to publish the identity of such organizations on the Internet and elsewhere and file an annual report with the Department of Revenue, and would require individual and corporate taxpayers to add back contributions made to such organizations 30 days after public notification was posted on the Internet.
Thank you for that summary, and we have the Attorney General with us today. Mr. Kroger, and anybody you want to bring up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. With me is Liz Grant, who is the attorney in charge of our charitable activities section. And what I'd like to do is briefly explain the problem that this bill addresses and its basic strategic goal, and then if it's acceptable to the chair, pass the microphone to Ms. Grant, and she will explain the details of the proposal. Madam Chair, the simple thing to say about this bill is that it's designed to address a very real and present problem in Oregon, and that is charities that are registered in the state and raising money in the state but go on to do almost no charitable work with the money they raise. Some of these charities are little more than scams. Other ones are so poorly managed and have such high overhead that they're really not accomplishing any productive social or public good. I'll give you three examples of charities that are currently operating in the state that fall in this category. The Korean War Veterans Museum and Library raises money over the telephone. They call people, they tell them correctly that Korean War veterans are in their 80s now, this is our last chance to do something to honor them. They raise funds. Unfortunately, of the money they raise, almost 97% goes to their own salaries and to overhead for their fundraising. So roughly 3 cents of every dollar is going to their charitable purpose, and 97 cents of every dollar is going to administrative costs, their salaries, and to pay their telemarketers. Another example is a organization called the Law Enforcement Education Program. This is an entity based in Michigan, and they claim to be raising money to help keep teenagers away from alcohol and to educate people about the effects of alcohol on teens. About 94 cents of every dollar they raise is going to their own salaries and to overhead. It's not going to a charitable purpose. One last example, an organization called Shiloh International Ministries. This is not a church. It is an organization that solicits money to provide supposedly help for needy children and the homeless. 97% roughly of the money that they raise goes to their own overhead and administrative expenses. 3% goes to their actual charitable purpose. When we are confronted with these charities in Oregon, the only tool we have at our disposal to regulate their activities currently is really the Unfair Trade Practices Act, the Consumer Protection Act. And it allows us to take legal action against these entities if they are deceiving in some material way the people they are soliciting money from. So if a charity says that they're going to pursue charitable activity A and then does something very different with the money, we would have the legal authority to take some action against them. And typically when we find that kind of behavior on an ongoing basis, we try to either shut down the charity or ban them from soliciting in Oregon. Those investigations are very fact-intensive and thus expensive. But more to the point, many of these organizations are not deceiving anyone. They're not making any false statements about their charitable activity or their charitable purpose. They're simply wasting the vast majority of the money they raise. And so the bill that that we have drafted and that we are proposing for your consideration and urge passage is to designed to address this problem. Currently, one of the things these folks can do to help raise money is to tell people, if they're raising money for a law enforcement charity, a veterans charity, or for children, that contributions to them are tax exempt. And the purpose of that exemption is to support charitable activity. We believe those contributions should not be exempt if they go to an organization that is not truly carrying out a legitimate charitable purpose or is wasting the overwhelming majority of the funds that are given to them. And so what this bill would do is give us the ability to disqualify charities that are not spending at least 30% of the money they raise on charitable activities, disqualifying them from being eligible to receive tax-deductible donations under Oregon law. The 30% figure, I'll give you some comparisons. Some of the best charities, Senator Telfer is very familiar with them, some of the best charities in the state will have 90% or 85% of the money that they raise go to the charitable function, 5 or 10 or 15% go to overhead. The Better Business Bureau recommends that people only donate to organizations that spend at least 65% of the money they raise for their charitable purpose. What we're saying is you should not qualify for tax deductibility if you fall below 30%. So it's a very low threshold, but one which will allow us to take appropriate action against the worst of the worst of these entities while not affecting the operations of legitimate charities. So that is the goal. I think it's an important bill. It's the first of its kind in the nation. But we think this problem, which has really started to explode in the last couple of years during this recession, makes this an important reform to undertake. And with that, if it's acceptable to the chair, I'd like to have Liz Grant explain the details of the legislation.
Before she does, I just have kind of a higher-level policy question. You mentioned that under the unfair trade practices provision, you can get somebody for deception. If someone said or put out a notification that they contributed 80% of what they raised to a charitable purpose when in fact they only did 5%, would that classify as deception that you could go after them for?
If they are making specific claims about how efficient their organization is and those turn out to be untrue, yes, that's something we could take action against. Unfortunately, most of these charities are not broadcasting any information about how much money goes to their charitable purpose. And sometimes we catch them, quite honestly, they're saying they'll do one thing with the money and they do something very different. But very few of these less efficient charities make any claims about their efficiency, and thus there's no way to prove that there's deception. People may assume that most of the money is going to charities, but there's no material lie there that we can use as the basis for a UTPA action.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is that when I was chairing Judiciary back in 2005 or 2007, can't remember what it was, this very same bill came before us. And it seems so obvious on the surface, but it turns out that in the implementation, it's a lot more difficult. So with that, maybe we should just hear some more of the details. Does anybody have any higher level questions before we get to the details? Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some more information about the details about how this proposal would work. First of all, I'll give some background information about how organizations qualify to receive tax-deductible donations. In order to do that, the organization has to make an application to the IRS to be recognized as a charity. This is typically referred to as 501c3 status. And so once the organization gets the determination from the IRS that they're eligible for 501c3 status, then they're eligible to receive tax-deductible donations. And right now, if they're eligible under federal law to receive tax-deductible donations, that same criteria applies here in Oregon. Once they have that 501c3 designation, those charitable organizations are required to file annual financial reports, and organizations that are over a certain income threshold, which will be $200,000 sort of effective this year, if they have that much in revenues, they're required to sort of allocate how much they spend on their charitable program, how much they spend on fundraising, and how much they spend on administration and management. So we have those reports in which they make those breakouts, and they detail their expenditures. So we've tracked that information, but until now there isn't much that we could do with it other than let people know that there's some of these organizations out there that provide very little charitable benefit or services for the money, for the donations they receive. And to also provide some context about why it is that we haven't really been able to do much with that information other than go after UTPA violations if they're making actionable false representations, assuming we are able to catch them doing that. Back in the 80s, there were, including Oregon, a number of states enacted legislation that prohibited charities from soliciting if they didn't meet certain thresholds in terms of their program expenditures. Those laws were basically struck down by the Supreme Court in a series of cases, a trilogy of cases, in which they ruled that barring organizations from soliciting on the basis of their administrative or fundraising expenses was too much of an infringement on those organizations' speech rights. And so as a result, all of that legislation was all repealed, and we're kind of in the situation that we're in today. But that's why we think that SB 40 provides the right alternative, because it focuses on the tax benefits associated with these organizations. And there's case law out there that says that who the government determines to give these tax deductions to and tax benefits to is a matter of policy and not really a matter of constitutional issues or speech rights. So that's why SB 40 focuses on the tax deductibility and requires that that the tax status of the organization be disclosed to potential donors in advance. And we think that the structure of SB 40 will withstand any challenge, because we don't think it raises the same constitutional issues that were raised in those Supreme Court cases.
Was that the Oregon Supreme Court or federal?
That was the U.S. Supreme Court. So
Oregon would be even more protected if there's speech rights.
That might be true, but I think that the way that SB 40 works, by focusing on the deductibility, there's no requirement that the government sort of subsidize this inefficient conduct. And so by eliminating the deductibility and requiring the disclosure of that information, we think that the law can have the intended impact and give donors the information that they need.
You said that you have the information on hand of what their breakdown is. Would there be anything stopping you from putting that on a website where donors would have access to?
Well, we are working on making that information more available. And, for example, during the holiday season, we posted information about some of the worst charities. And there's other places that one can go on the Internet to find these reports.
Right. Chair Burdick, the simple answer is that's a priority of ours, and we're going to be gradually moving in that direction. It's in part a funding issue to do the website work that will be necessary to make it simple and automated to get the information up there. But I would think in the next 2 years, I'm hopeful that all that information will be available to the public on our website.
It would seem to me it wouldn't just be a threshold issue, but if you care about animals, you'd want to go on a website and find out which animal protection organization provides the most. You'd rather give the one that does 95% than 90%. And so that would have real value. Senator Telfer.
Well, Chair Burdick, that information is, it's on GuideStar. All 501c3s are scanned by the IRS, sent over to GuideStar. That information already is on the website. So I wouldn't want to see us duplicate something that's already there. And with the IRS, if somebody loses their tax-exempt status, and many of these are going to lose their tax-exempt status eventually when the IRS actually starts looking at them, they're pulled off Pub 78, which is the listing of those that are approved. So I wouldn't want us to duplicate that, but maybe highlight, which is what I think you're doing, is highlight those that have been disqualified. But the information is already there.
Okay. Well, that's useful to know. I didn't know that. Maybe just a simple link would work.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there other questions? So if you looked into the background of this, I cannot for the life of me remember why it didn't go through back when.
Chair Burdick, if I may, we've looked at the legislative history and the discussions around the prior proposal. I have to be honest with you, I, for the life of me, can't figure out why it didn't pass either. There was an objection, I believe, from an entity that had a financial interest in doing telemarketing for charitable activities that objected to the bill, and that seemed to be enough to stop it. And I would hope that we would not repeat that experience.
All right. And is there any reason why you put the threshold so low at 30%?
Chair Burdick, I think the simple thing to say is we really don't want to penalize any legitimate charitable activity, and we want to make sure, and the bill is crafted to make sure that we don't interfere with new entities that are starting up and thus may be less efficient, or entities that are conducting a capital campaign and thus may be spending less money on their charitable purpose short term. We wanted to make sure that we had a tool to go after the worst of the worst, but not penalize legitimate charities, even if they are particularly small ones, less efficient. And we worked very close with the philanthropy and charitable community to work out what everyone thought was an appropriate level. And I think everyone's comfortable that this will give us the tools we need to make sure that the least effective charities are not soliciting in Oregon.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
It occurs to me that one shoe does not fit all charitable organizations. Some are raising for a project, as you mentioned. Others are raising for staff to perform the mission of whatever that charitable organization is doing. It seems to me that the language in the bill gives your office pretty wide latitude. It has to be consistent with their filings on the 990, but pretty wide latitude in determining what qualifies and doesn't qualify. Do you have any sense of, you know, the criteria more specifically that you would use?
I think I'll let Liz answer that question.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the exemption, there is, in fact, an exemption in the bill for the type of organization that might be accumulating revenues and donations for the purpose of some sort of campaign that's consistent with their solicitation. Most of the very worst organizations are not accumulating revenue. They're spending money as fast as it comes in. So that is one exception that we found that seems appropriate to exclude that from this disqualification list. To be honest, we've applied this criteria in developing the 20 worst list, and it seems to be a pretty fair criteria, and we haven't really found other situations in which it seems like a disqualification would not be appropriate, although the legislation does allow us to enact rules in the event that we realize that situations emerge that we're not presently aware of.
Senator Morse, I don't think this is a case where there's a huge amount of discretion built in. I think what we've got is a very low but very concrete threshold that organizations will have to meet. So if this were a case where we had discretion to pick and choose who was getting exemptions, I think that would be a deep concern. Part of the reason the threshold is low is to make sure that we're not in that position. That what we're really trying to do is set a basic rule of the minimal charitable purpose that an entity has to have before it qualifies for tax status. So I'm not too worried about the impact of discretion of regulators on the exercise of the or the functioning of the bill.
Senator Telfer.
You know, as you're well aware, you know, I do hundreds. Myself and my firm do hundreds of these things a year, many of which are in Oregon. And I know that the clients, in many cases, don't properly allocate between programs and supporting services of fundraising administration. They just don't know how to do it. And they don't bother. They don't see the significance. So the kind of a two-part question is the methodology of allocating expenses to those three functions is not black and white. And even the IRS has it's not black and white. And so it looks to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it looks to me that the bill gives you a little bit of flexibility for a nonprofit to, within 60 days, to come forward and say, well, you know, we messed up, and to be able to have the opportunity to recalculate. I don't know what your basis or methodology for those allocations might be. I assume they're probably as loose as the IRS. But the other part of the question is the opposite could happen, where, you know, you get somebody that's put it all into program when, in fact, it shouldn't be. And even the IRS has done audits where they found that 1 in 10 nonprofits lists anything in fundraising, in the fundraising column. 1 in 10, and they were going to pull the tax-exempt status on all of them because they said part of your purpose is to raise money, and you weren't allocating any costs. So I guess my concern would be, what's your underlying methodology on those allocations, number one? And number two, if, in fact, there's a lot in program, would you be auditing them to see if, in fact, they really are below the 30% and they should be changing the way they allocate between those three columns?
Chair Burdick, I'll take a first stab, and then I'll pass it to Liz. They're required to report accurate data to the state, and that data would be the data on which we would base our determinations. As you note, there is an ability for them to come back if it's determined that they're not eligible for tax deductibility status, to come back and have a discussion about their data so that we can correct any problems. This system is based on the accuracy of the self-reporting of the information from the entities themselves. It will not cure the problem of entities either intentionally or negligently reporting false data. But Ms. Grant and her staff do review an enormous number of these, as I think you're probably aware. And so when they see things that are anomalous, that does start a dialogue with the charitable entities. To make sure that they do understand what they're required to report and that they're reporting it accurately. So I don't think that alone is going to be a huge burden or a huge problem for the entities, because they're already required to make these reports. It may encourage them to do it more accurately because they'll understand that this has a greater legal significance now. But Liz, would you care to add anything? Or
I think that that pretty much covers it.
This is also a test to make sure I understand how our charitable activities unit operates.
All right. Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay. Carrie Hoops and Ross Laybourne.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. My name is Carrie Hoops. We reside in Portland, Oregon, and I'm the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. With me today is one of my board members, Ross Laybourne, and I just want to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. The Nonprofit Association of Oregon is a statewide nonprofit support organization and membership association that provides training and consulting. NAO represents over 500 Oregon nonprofits and affiliate organizations. Our members are located throughout the state, and they come from all major areas that serve our communities, including education, health, arts, environmental protection, health and human services. NEO's mission is to strengthen the collective voice, leadership, and capacity of Oregon nonprofits, and we do this by conducting training, executive transitions, and consulting services, and also moving into public policy and advocacy work on behalf of the sector. Our organization is one of 38 state associations around the country. We are members of the National Council of Nonprofits, which is the largest nonprofit network in the United States, working through its member state associations to help amplify the voices of America's community-based nonprofit organizations, helping them engage in critical policy issues, managing and leading more effectively, and coming up with solutions that are impacting our communities. We support the passage of SB 40 as drafted, and we support the Attorney General's efforts to expose and publicize dishonorable charities through the introduction of this new regulatory legislation. As you've heard earlier, this bill would disqualify certain charitable organizations from receiving contributions that are deductible for Oregon tax purposes if the Attorney General finds that they are failing to expend at least 30% of their total annual functional expenses on program services averaged over the organization's last three fiscal years. We think that 30% is a percentage that Oregon nonprofits can live with, and we think the provisions that he's making in the bill make sense. We also like that it imposes no additional regulatory burdens on roughly 98% of the charities that are operating in the state. Ross Laybourne, one of our board members and former Assistant Attorney General, would like to say a few words if that's okay with you.
Chair Burdick, for the record, my name is Ross Laybourne. I reside in Portland, and I am an at-large member, board member of NAO. As Carrie just mentioned, you know, we all bring our perspective to public policy issues and background, and part of mine is that I worked for 20 years as Liz Grant's predecessor as chair of the head of the charitable activities section. You know, this problem is not brand new. It's been with us, and in my own defense, in terms of having not solved that problem in 20 years, I would say two things. One, the IRS, you know, we're kind of dependent on the IRS screening of tax-exempt organizations, and I think that for the last few years, they've done a pretty good job, but for a long time, they didn't pay much attention to tax-exempt organizations, and frankly, they were giving out tax-exempt status like candy. And so looking just at the National Center of Charitable Statistics, in 2009, we know that there were over 1 million organizations, active operating charities in the United States with 501c3 status. So it's been given out to a lot of organizations, and in a number of cases, probably organizations that shouldn't have received tax-exempt status. We also know, as Attorney General Kroger and Liz Grant referenced, that the other institutional problem has been the United States Supreme Court in terms of kind of moving the bar in terms of what was permissible in the way of state regulation. Every time the court, Liz referred to a trilogy of cases, the court would come down with a decision, we would go back and we'd say, okay, we think we know where the bar is. We'd go back and submit legislation, the legislature would pass that legislation, and then we'd find out 3 years later that that, too, was unconstitutional. I think that the proposal before you in terms of Senate Bill 40, I think is probably the next best solution in terms of that evolution of possible state legislation to deal with this problem. And I think it has a real chance of to the extent that it is challenged in the future, being constitutional, unlike some of the prior proposals. Substantively, you'd ask about the decision in terms of 30%. I think it's a pretty good shot. Obviously, it's an arbitrary level. But one of the things that I would add to the mix would be the foremost rater right now of charities in the country is an organization called Charity Navigator. They have a pretty extensive mechanism for scoring charities and looking at their organizational efficiency. But to just briefly summarize from their website, they say, our data shows that 7 out of 10 charities we've evaluated spend at least 75% of their budget on programs and services they exist to provide. And 9 out of 10 spend at least 65%. We believe that those spending less than a third, 33%, of their budget on program expenses are simply not living up to their missions. Charities demonstrating such gross inefficiency receive 0 points for their overall efficiency score. So if you look at their rating system, how you get zero in terms of just being viewed as a totally non-productive charity, it's under 33%. And I think it's very consistent with the concept of Senate Bill 40. And certainly if Charity Navigator and organizations like that look at these organizations and say, we're going to give you 0 points for your charitable mission, then the obvious question is, why should states like the state of Oregon be subsidizing those particular charities? And I think it's a worthy concept. And with that, I'm sure that Carrie and I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Thank you. Any questions for the committee? We don't have anybody signed up in opposition to this. Have you, in your dealings, have you heard any concerns from the nonprofit community, maybe individual members or whatever, that we should be aware of?
We have not yet. We've just been, just started yesterday, communicating with our members about this bill and have issued a press release that the association is in support of it. And that just went out yesterday, so.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Jim Willis. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Prior to that appointment, I served 32 years in law enforcement and retired from general headquarters with the Oregon State Police. During that last 10 years at General Headquarters and as a Bureau Commander, one of my divisions was the Office of the State Fire Marshal. And I point that out because I'm going to talk about charities in terms of the human face for just a second. And it can come down to things like hunger or handicap or heroes. So let me talk about the latter. Firefighters, police officers, and veterans are often seen by the general public of our society, at least, as heroes, people to be respected, people to be emulated. And as a result, those people who choose to illegally solicit funds on behalf of a pseudo-charity will do it oftentimes in the name of assisting firefighters or the children of deceased firefighters, police officers, or veterans. It's probably one of the most egregious kinds of acts that's done in our society. One of the most victimized groups within our society by these charities are seniors. And it's usually a telephone solicitation occurring in a boiler room operation that is literally here today and gone tomorrow. But it's too late. They've got the credit card number or they've got the credit card deposit, and then they're off to the next place wherever they go. We have had those kinds of things occur in our state, both while I was still in law enforcement and since I've been Director of Veterans Affairs. I think Senate Bill 40 will help immensely in terms of both the reporting and the ability to go after these kinds of people, and quite frankly, just make it very uncomfortable to do business in this state if you're going to do it illegally. So I applaud the efforts of the Attorney General and our legitimate nonprofits for the very good work that they do. I work with some that are very legitimate, that I'm very proud of, and so I just urge the committee's favorable consideration of Senate Bill 40, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
I think I heard about 3 careers in there.
Yes, ma'am.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that ends our list of testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to speak on this? Okay, thank you again to the Attorney General. And with that, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 40. And open a public hearing on, is the treasurer? Where's his? Both of these? He wants to do 19. And then, so I should do these all separately. Okay. All right, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 19. Mazin.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Senate Bill 19 comes to you from the State Treasurer Office. The Senate Bill 19 primarily continues the work that you've started in the previous session. You sent the Measure 72 to the voters, and it was voted on in the general election of 2010, November, where it authorized the creation of Article 11Q bonds and placed those in the Constitution. This, of course, put the constitutional language in place. Those bonds are intended to replace the form of borrowing that usually dominates the certificate of participation, the COPs. This bill puts basically the construct, the legal construct, the enabling language, and the process by which those bonds would be used by the governor and the executive branch. So it builds the different accounts where the monies go in and how it's serviced and so on, and how it will be authorized either through the bond bill or through the budget process.
Thank you. And we have the honor of our state treasurer here to speak on this. And you wanted to bring Laura up with you. Good. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler, State Treasurer. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 19. Senate Bill 19 provides implementation language for Ballot Measure 72, which was overwhelmingly passed by the voters in the November election. Ballot Measure 72 created a Article 11Q in the Constitution, which allows the legislature to authorize bonds at a favorable interest rate for the state of Oregon. What was formerly certificates of participation with no promise to repay on the part of the state can now be issued or refinanced as general obligation debt with a constitutional promise for us to pay. The language provides a statutory avenue for the legislature to authorize such debt should you choose to do so. There are savings through the restructuring of debt under Senate Bill 19. Specifically, Senate Bill 19 restructures some of the certificates of participation in order to realize interest savings of as much as $70 million over the life of those bonds. Assuming all $350 million in the certificates of participation that were authorized by the legislature in the 2009 session and planned for our April sale would be sold instead as 11Q bonds, we would save approximately 0.75% in interest costs, or a total of about $48.2 million over the life of the bonds. Savings would show up in the general fund starting in the next fiscal year. Senate Bill 19 also allows for refunding of approximately $82 million of outstanding certificates of participation. This saves about $4.4 million over what ordinary refinancing would save the state over the life of the bonds. Savings would show up over time to the general fund. Finally, several Department of Transportation projects, which will be financed as 11Q bonds rather than ODOT revenue bonds, would save approximately 0.8% 5% on interest rates, or a total of about $18 million over the life of the bonds. Because these bonds use transportation revenues as repayment, savings would show up in this case in the highway fund. A couple of key points. First of all, it's important to note that the restructuring does not alter the source of repayment for any of these borrowings, but only lowers the interest rate that the state pays. Second of all, the Treasury has some specific amendments to Senate Bill 19 pertaining to the specific COPs that would be refinanced. I would encourage that we commit to pass it out of committee pending the receipt of the amendments that we'd like to propose to Senate Bill 19. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And why don't you tell the committee why it's a good thing we have this in place right now?
It's a great thing that we have this in place. And I brought Laura Lockwood McCall, who's our senior debt manager for the state of Oregon, who could probably shed additional details. But with the municipal bond market in what I would politely describe as disarray, there really isn't a viable market at this time for certificates of participation. We obviously had no idea that that would be the case when Measure 72 went to the ballot. But now that it's happened, it makes us look very smart in retrospect that we now have an alternative to the certificate of participation market. So it not only saves us money on interest costs, it may in fact be the only viable source of debt capacity in the current market conditions. And I would certainly encourage Laura
to committee,
chime in.
The committee was before its time, as we often are. And
you saw the market and the world in a way nobody else anticipated.
We were fully aware. We just didn't talk about it because we didn't want to scare people.
Very well done.
Yeah. Laura, do you want to?
Through the chair, Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division in the Treasurer's Office. I mentioned to Ted that the idea of doing this, every year we get, what are some legislative concepts that you would like to do? And at the time, Senator who became Treasurer Westland's office said, well, do you have an idea? And I went to our bond counsel, longstanding bond counsel, Harvey Rogers, and I said, do you have any good ideas? He said, well, I have one, which is the COPs. Why don't we do them as GO bonds? Maybe the time has come. We've got $1 billion of them outstanding. It's kind of obvious that we need to finance state office buildings in prisons and mental hospitals. And so I floated the idea. Other treasurers didn't really want to take it on. It was not, particularly sexy. But he said yes. And you all said yes. And the voters said yes. And we're very smart and very lucky. Starting about November of this past year, we started seeing a lot of headline risk about municipal bond market. We started hearing about pension problems. We started hearing about budget crises because they weren't going to be any more ARRA money. And while there are a few states and some cities that are really struggling, those are the places I think I've testified before that this isn't the first time they've had problems. They've had longstanding financial problems, and this particular downturn in the economy is just exacerbated the problem. But the whole municipal bond market has suffered. In the last 2 months, there's been huge outflows from the municipal bond market. It was kind of a safety place that people went during the crisis in the stock market and in the aftermath of Lehman's bankruptcy. And so now, and interest rates just kept dropping because, of course, so many people went in our market. So ironically, rates have shot up over 100 basis points, but they're kind of at the normal rates that municipal bonds used to be at. Having said that, though, investors, retail investors, are very spooked because as interest rates go up, the price goes down. And so we're finding it very difficult right now to find people to buy at the long end of the yield curve, the longer dated bonds. I'm also finding we haven't sold, which is fortunate, but the feedback I'm getting from bankers is that the markets are really choppy. And with COPs, just to be really clear, it's not that we don't pledge to pay. It's just not our full faith and credit. It's subject to annual appropriation risk. And if we didn't pay, our credit rating would be trash. So there's sort of we need to pay. But the thing about a full faith and credit from a legal perspective is that a bondholder has a higher likelihood of repaying because it is full faith and credit, which is why we get a better interest rate and a higher credit rating. It's our best credit rating. So as the treasurer has described to you, when we first proposed this idea, we were trying to be conservative. Maybe we'd save 20, 30 basis points, and my staff and I would argue. And even when I wrote the report 2 weeks ago, I said 50, And I called the folks at Citigroup who were going to sell bonds for us, and I said, tell me today. And they said, well, it's 75 basis points today. And I can't guarantee it'll be 75 basis points when we sell in April, but I can guarantee you that until the market's calm and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the 60 Minutes decide that maybe we're not all going over the cliff, it would be wise for us to finish off the state mental hospital using GO bonds rather than COPs, because I may not be able to actually find buyers if it was COPs. And I think part of our urgency to move this bill, and obviously we need to talk about which projects are in or out, and that's not really our job, it's your job, is that we want to sell in April. Now, we could sell later, but, you know, that there are other bond issues for higher ed and lottery and other folks, so we sort of have it sort of planned out at this point for a lot of different bond sales, and we try to separate them by a few weeks so that we can get retail investors. There's a certain appetite. So that is why we've sort of come early in the session and asked you to consider passing this legislation, and I'm open to questions if you have any.
Thank you. Could you just go over briefly when we might expect the amendments and what basically the amendments are going to do?
Well, part of them are things that Department of Administrative Services, and
do you know when the amendments will be ready?
It's really more in the DAS realm, I think.
Okay, this probably isn't fair, but maybe you could just tell us when we would expect them, because I assume you've got a little bit of time urgency on this.
Mike, I can't answer that.
Can I
have
questions?
Sure.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the State Treasury. The amendments were submitted at the earliest possible time at the first day of session. It is my understanding from discussions I've had with legislative staff that legislative council is now prioritizing new bill requests that are due on February 14th.
Okay.
This, I expect to have the amendments finished after that date, but hopefully very soon after, as we've submitted very specific language to legislative council. So I would hopefully expect them sometime next week.
Okay, so you have an emergency clause on here, so as long as you get it through by, what, mid-March?
Jack, we're selling the week of April 19th.
Yes,
I think we need to mail our, through the chair, we need to mail our official statement, the preliminary official statement to investors, generally a week or two early. So I'd say we would like, in our perfect world, that it's gone through the entire process by the beginning of April.
Okay.
That way the lawyers can say that it's all hunky-dory, but that includes getting to the governor and getting it signed.
Right. Well, this is a very fast-acting committee, so you won't expect any. And we're very lean, too.
So. Hopefully not mean.
No, we're very kind.
Just lean.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an academic question. What is the typical term of a COP versus a GO?
Through the chair, Senator Morris, different projects have different terms. So if we finance, let's say, a SoftWorks system, that's usually a five-year term. The buildings, I'm going to look to my colleague Jack Kenny, but I believe it's 20 to 25 years. And we're not suggesting changing anything, because that's a project-by-project analysis that we do as we put together bond issues. So we're really not going to refinance and stretch out debt. It's just simply whatever the term was, an existing COP will be the same term as well.
It seems that maybe we've abused the COPs over the years in financing things that we shouldn't have used that vehicle. Obviously, that's why we're moving in this direction. I assume then that the COPs would be used for short-term and the type of investments where the maturity would match essentially the depreciable life of the asset.
Through the chair, Senator Morris, my vision would be if the CUBE legislation's passed, we won't sell COPs ever again, that we'll sell short-term GO bonds if it's a short-term project, or long-term GO bonds if it's a longer-term project, so that we'll see over time COPs going away, because the voters have authorized us now for any state office building or state project, land purchase, equipment, that this particular vehicle that and the legislature will determine all those projects and the overall amounts in the bond bill as part of your normal deliberations. But I don't envision us selling COPs if this legislation ever again. because we'll get a better credit rating and a lower cost of funds through the GO bonds.
Just as Paul, and I imagine then the term of the bond would be commensurate with the life of the asset.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Through
okay.
the chair. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll look for the amendments and work with your office to try to get this through quickly.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 19 and open. Should we do this one?
Sure.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 13.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 13 first attempt when you read the Senate Bill 13, it tries to clarify that semi-independent state agencies, their borrowing should not be thought of as an obligation of the state of Oregon or the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. And at first, when you read this, you think there's something big that happened, and that was my first question. Did somebody try to steal the faith and credit of the state government? And I guess probably it's not that limit yet. However, the second question, that which are semi-independent agencies, and I put in your SMS stipulation of the number of those, you'd have in the background the boards such as the Appraiser Certification License Board, State Board of Architects, and so on. And the bill itself also specifies the Oregon Film and Video Office and Travel Information Council, Oregon Corrections Enterprise, as ones to be the ones specified into the bill, and not to have that confusion of the faith and credit of the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Are you Cynthia?
No, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, my name is Kelly Page. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Optometry. I'm one of the semi-independent agencies.
Okay, you are signed up first. I'm just wondering if we should take the treasurer first. I think we'll have you stand down and let the
no
treasurer
problem.
Come up and get started. Thank you. Oh. And Michael Savaggio and Cynthia Burns. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, once again, my name is Michael Savaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. Senate Bill 13 deals with the borrowing authority of semi-independent state agencies, of which Oregon has a handful. Some semi-independent agencies have borrowing authority, some do not, and because of this, they may borrow independently, such as they may decide to put something on the market, they may decide to go directly for a bank loan, but since that happens independently of legislative action, statute clarifies that these borrowings do not in any way constitute an obligation of the state. But since these authorities were set up over different periods of time, this language differs ever so slightly from agency to agency. So upon discussing this fact with counsel, we became concerned that over time, differing language could be interpreted as differing legislative intent. And, of course, the intent in this regard needs to be explicitly the same, which is there is absolutely no obligation on the state for these borrowings. So this bill is not intended to have any practical effect whatsoever on the actual abilities of these agencies. What it is intended to do is to clarify and, most importantly, standardize the language across ORS and hopefully prevent the need for a broader review and revision process down the road. So with that, I will of course, this, like our previous bill, is waiting on an amendment, but this, to my knowledge, does not have any kind of emergency time frame on it. So with that, I'll turn it over to the committee, and I have Cynthia Burns from the Department of Justice here to answer any technical questions you may have.
Okay. Basically, what you're saying is that this is not expected to change any of the ground rules that agencies are already operating under. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that's correct. It is our intention to allow these agencies to continue to borrow, but simply to standardize the language for the purposes of clarifying to the lenders that the state is under no obligation.
Okay, and you don't expect this to have any effect on interest rates or availability of credit or anything like that?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we do not. And I did manage to contact the three agencies that are specifically mentioned in the current draft of the bill. And although I don't believe I have official resolutions from their respective boards, none of them raised any particular concern over it.
Okay. We're about to hear from one of them, so we'll check it out. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Now we will have Kelly Page. Thank you for waiting. And signed up with you is Stephen Kapoor. Is he in the room?
He had to go to another meeting.
Okay. So. Well, you're on your own then.
Okay. No problem. Sorry I jumped again.
That's all right. Happened before.
And Chair Burdick and members of the committee, again, my name is Kelly Page. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Optometry. I'm not one of the agencies specifically named, but I just wanted to appear and say that the majority of the semi-independent agencies were completely fine. I guess our stated position is neutral on this bill. We had a meeting in January. We have bi-monthly meetings of the group, and we were kind of curious about this bill because we had always assumed that we were pretty much on our own in case we ever decided to purchase property or make investments of any significant degree. So the report I've given you is a report that we just recently prepared about kind of a summary of what it's like to be a semi-independent agency. It's just for information purposes only. And we want to reassure the committee that we don't intend to invest with the Nigerians or buy oceanfront property in Oklahoma. And we do not expect the state of Oregon to back us up if we do so.
Okay, thank you. That's reassuring.
Okay.
Are there questions from the committee?
Well, it's the if we do so, Madam Chair. you do raise an interesting question. What is the corpus of debt that's held by these independent agencies? Do we know? Is it reported anywhere? I don't recall seeing that reported.
He asked what is the amount of debt that's held by the independent agencies. You may not be the right person to ask. We may address
my
that.
Agency doesn't have any debt. And to my knowledge, I don't know that anyone else does. We have a money market account with U.S. Bank, but none of us have any real property. We're allowed to own. For example, we could, if we wanted, get together, buy a building that we all have offices in, but no one's gone ahead and done that.
Actually, that's a good question. Maybe we could drag Michael back or Cynthia to help answer that question. What's happening on the ground in the debt area, to the best of your knowledge?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this is where the independent portion of semi-independent comes into play. to my knowledge, and I think Cynthia or Laura can correct me if I'm wrong, the Treasury does not receive reports of debt of semi-independent agencies.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, sort of the on-the-ground reason for some of this bill is I don't believe that they do report their borrowings to the state treasurer, so I don't know that the state knows what's out there. But there have been proposals floated over the years that have ended up coming through general counsel through various semi-independent agencies that had borrowing terms that were not particularly favorable, that had provisions buried in the documents that would allow someone to take that debt, stick a state seal on it, and market it as an obligation of the state of Oregon that looked very much like an ODOT revenue bond. So this bill is intended to tighten that up so that if a semi-independent agency does borrow, that borrowing doesn't get turned over to the secondary market and packaged with other borrowings or things like that and sold as something that to the market might appear like an ODOT revenue bond or a regular State of Oregon revenue borrowing.
Oh, no. Are we looking at another financial bubble here? Are we looking at derivatives? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, it does raise a legitimate question with respect to accountability and reporting, so that at somewhere, sometime, someone's looking at the accumulation of debt in these semi-independent agencies.
Who would we even go to for something like that?
May I make a comment?
Sure.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we do, each semi-independent agency prepares a big report to the governor, the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House of Representatives, and the legislative fiscal office every biennium. And we present our budget with all our revenue, expenses, assets, liabilities, and so there is considerable oversight of our agencies.
So the oversight would include at least having the amount of debt public and before
yes,
them.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Different new area here. Okay, well, thank you very much. Anybody else in the room who want to testify? Okay. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 13. And we got one more.
Thank you.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 20.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 20 comes to you from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, MDEC, and the commission looks at different issues. This is for the municipal borrowing and local government finance, and every session brings at least, as far as I remember, at least one bill to the committee. And then this session, it brings Senate Bill 20, and what it tries to or attempts to do is to look at the main thing with it at this time. Before, I believe this would probably need amendments, is to allow for the local governments to refinance and repurchase their debt and hold it back in the same without going through the same rigorous transactions that they had to go through the first time. And then there is probably some cleanup language also of the amounts that you would have in the number of days that they need to put challenge for when they, as you would see in section 3 and then the section 3 and primarily puts some of the agencies with the drafting of the municipal debt language that was done with 287A, and that you would find in the rest of the sections from 7 till the end of the bill.
Okay, we've got one witness signed up, Carol McCoog. You? You don't look like Carol, but you're welcome at all times.
Good Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. And I'd like to point out, first and foremost, that we are so organized at Treasury, we have put the amendments with for this bill with the amendments for our other bills in LSA for safekeeping. So, so as staff mentioned, we are not prepared to pass this out today, but we'll speak to the amendments. And I'll just give you a short background and point out that when the Law Commission, I believe it was in 2005, made blanket revisions to the local bonding statutes, we have been, I've been corrected, it was 2007. The Municipal Debt Advisory Commission has been identifying shortcomings with those revisions since then, little by little, and we have identified five, which you have before you today. Most of these are simple clarifications of authority that we believe is, for the most part, existing already, and we've been asked by bond counsel to clear up so that they feel more confident in their relationships. The legislation we have in front of you speaks in large part to sewage district bonds, I believe. That is the result of an example that we've listed, I think, on item under item number four in the handout that you should have in front of you. It is not our intent to make this entire bill about sewage district bonds. I will let Carol McCoog from the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission briefly go over the five general areas that we're seeking to clarify.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol McCoog. I am a partner with the law firm of K&L Gates, and we serve as bond counsel to a number of state agencies, as well as numerous Oregon local governments. And I currently serve as chair of the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. As Michael Salvaggio described, Senate Bill 20 is generally a housekeeping and clarification bill. I think you have been provided with a summary of the bill, and I'll briefly go through the five, what we've listed as primary effects of the legislation with the amendments. The first two items of the bill, what we've summarized, actually build on the theme from the last legislative session when we were in the midst of coping with the financial meltdown. During that session, the legislature adopted legislation that clarified the authority for state and local governments to purchase their bonds, primarily auction rate bonds and variable rate demand bonds, as a way to cope with the collapse of those markets and avoid paying exorbitant interest rates on those bonds. One thing that we should have included in that bill was a clarification that local governments can use current refunding bond proceeds to purchase those bonds, in essence affecting a refinancing of those bonds that have, again, are part of a market that has collapsed. And refunding them out with current refunding bonds. But the term purchase is more applicable to the structure of auction rate bonds and variable rate demand bonds. And so that's why we would want to clarify the current refunding statute to incorporate the purchase of bonds as well as refunding bonds. Another common type of restructuring that occurred as a coping mechanism for issuers with bonds outstanding was to convert, for example, variable rate demand bonds from one interest rate mode to another interest rate mode. So, for example, a bond in weekly mode to convert that into a long-term fixed rate mode. And one thing that the hospital facilities authorities wanted some clarification on was that they could use bond proceeds to pay for the costs associated with these conversions. When you do a conversion, there are disclosures that need to be made, legal fees associated with that, and so they just wanted clarification that proceeds can be used to pay for those costs to convert the bonds. Also included in a bill, the bill is a very technical fix to conform the start date of the timeline for citizens to petition the use of general obligation bond proceeds to the start date that is appears in the same statute for other sorts of petitions, like for property tax petitions. It's just a little bit off right now in terms of when you start those time frames. So we just want to tweak the statute to conform those start dates on the timeline. And finally, as Mike mentioned in the Law Commission bill in 2007, that bill was adopted to streamline the public finance statutes for both the state and Oregon local governments. And the result was a codification of public finance statutes in 286A for the state and 287A for local governments. In creating this omnibus public finance statute for local governments, a lot of the local government specific chapters were modified in terms of their bonding statutes to cross-reference 287A so that the local governments could take advantage of the structuring and administration type statutes in the omnibus public finance statutes. As we've worked with them under a number of years, we've noticed that a couple of stragglers still remain in some of the local government specific chapters, and for example, the sanitary districts still have some specific prescriptive language about structuring bonds. They say that they have to be in $5,000 increments. They say that interest must be paid semi-annually. Well, sometimes these folks will want to issue bonds that are paid where the interest is paid annually. Sometimes the increments need to be different than $5,000. And so we found in some of these hidden and buried in various chapters as we've worked with local governments. And so in lieu of having to scour the chapters and going through and finding the very specific statutes, we would like to put something in the omnibus statute of 287A to make it clear that local governments can rely on the statutes in 287A for structuring and administration of their bonds. We're not adding any authority. We're not overriding any authority. This is just something that governments can look to for structuring flexibility. And finally, again, working with the Law Commission's 287A as a practitioner under these statutes, we've noticed that the refunding statutes are a little bit awkward in that it's not very clear as to how a local government can issue a refunding bond to refund out, for example, a state loan that they've taken out where the state itself can't facilitate a refinancing, even in a lower interest rate market. For whatever reason, the state program may be limited in their ability to refinance. So local governments would like the ability to do refunding bonds to take advantage of debt service savings. And the refunding statutes are just a little bit awkward and clunky and don't clarify the procedure associated with that. So we are seeking to clarify those statutes so that local governments will have the flexibility to do that kind of refund. And that's my summary of the, like I said, the five primary effects of the legislation. I'm happy to answer questions.
I think the real message here is thank heavens for the Oregon Law Commission. Is there anybody who even wants to venture a question on this? Thank you, and thank you for your work on this. This is very important work, but very technical and detailed, so we really do appreciate the effort.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 20. Any other business before the committee? We are adjourned.